This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Yes, Tech Talk. Good afternoon. I'm Frida Liu. Human beings are remarkably resilient creatures. Despite the best efforts of our planet to destroy us, we regularly show the ingenuity to cheat its dastardly attempts at turning us into a new genus, hominis extincti. Yes, you guessed it. Culture pop Samad Amdich wants to talk about disease again. And let me just feel that forehead of yours. Have you not been feeling well?
Hi, Frida. I'm quite well, actually, but thank you for your concern. No, I'm going back to something I was saying at the beginning of the year. I think we've run out of a lot of exciting ideas for consumer tech. I think we're a couple of leaps away from the kind of innovation that's going to make it exciting again, you know, things like breaking our reliance on devices with screens. So, you know, we're pushing our devices, consumer devices anyway, to the very limit of the technology that we have. So we're waiting for that next jump in screen technology, in battery tech, in streaming speeds. And for the time being, it's going to be these endless incremental improvements that, you know, we find quite boring. But when you look at industrial and medical technology, we're seeing developments that are really eye-opening from a pure tech point of view. But I do understand that a lot of these developments are kind of, you know, less exciting to people like our listeners. But I'm going to talk about all of this anyway.
Yes, which brings us back to coughs and sneezes.
Well, a couple of years back, the world faced the threat of a global pandemic in the form of Ebola. Our broadcast on the viral spread of diseases, including Ebola, actually coincided with the virus being contained because I checked the dates. Was it a coincidence? I mean, I'm not saying, Frida, that you and I halted the Ebola epidemic. I'm just echoing what other people have said, important, influential people. It's their opinion. It's not mine. I'm just repeating what they've said. And now I think it's our duty to save the world again.
Again.
To tell the world how the medical community has moved on since those days, how it's been adopting new techniques and technologies that will actually help to thwart the threat and the development of all of these new diseases.
Okay, so let's tell the good people at home what they've got to be worried about.
Well, thanks to the new scientists for putting this snappy list together. These are the diseases that the World Health Organization think pose the biggest threat to us humanities. And can I have some music for this, please? Okay, good afternoon, pop pickers, and what a day it is to get ill. Straight in at number 8, we have a relative unknown. Discovered in 2011, severe fever with thrombocytopenia syndrome. It's very difficult to say. It tends to be found in East Asia. It's spread by farm animals and ticks, and it can cause organs to fail, killing around 12% of the people that it infects.
I love how the music's changing.
Exactly. At number 7, we have our old news favourite, Zika, the monkey virus, whose cute name makes it sound like a South American dance, but belies the fact that it actually causes deformities in infants. At 6, with echoes of our old chum dengue, we have another friend of the Aedes mosquito, which is chikungunya, another very hard one to say, which has made its way across Africa and into Asia.
Coming here.
Yeah. Not much of a killer, but it does make you feel like you've got flu for months and months of at a time. And of course, now we move into the all-important top 5. At 5 is another lesser-known entrant, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. Try saying that on a Friday night out. Again, spread by ticks. Most people only get very mild symptoms, but strains are developing that can cause internal bleeding with a frightening mortality rate of around 30%. No surprises for the next one. Straight into the top 5 at number 4 is the coronavirus family that includes SARS and MERS, causing severe pneumonia in sufferers that can lead to death. And sneaking in nastily to our number 3 position, yes, you've guessed it, it's Rift Valley fever. Found in cattle and spread by those Flying Fun Palaces mosquitoes, you can actually catch it by eating infected beef. And like its Crimean Congo friend, Symptoms are usually mild, but if it develops into a hemorrhagic fever, it will actually kill around 50% of those it infects. Very nasty one. Hello, number two. We know you. Yes, it's Nipah, the bat virus that we all love to hate. Still a regular feature in Bangladesh. It causes inflammation of the brain and is very often fatal. You know, we should do this kind of thing more often. It's really fun, right? Okay. In at number one, yes, it's the world's greatest retroviral rock star. It is Lassa fever. It's spread by rats and it infects more than 300,000 people across West Africa every year, killing more than 5,000 people along the way. Just like Lady Gaga, it's a master of mimicry and it makes every style its own as it copies the symptoms of a lot of other illnesses and diseases and makes it very hard to diagnose and to discover when an outbreak is taking place.
Wow. But yeah, I don't think I've done the top 10 of diseases that way before.
No, I'm expecting to get shot when I leave today.
You know, Ebola isn't on the list.
No, but that's because there's actually a number 9 spot on the top 8 list. And that's what they call a novel agent. That's a spot that's left open for an unknown or relatively obscure germ. When you look at something like Ebola, we've known about it for quite some time, but its outbreaks have generally been remote. They've been pretty small, and they've tended to burn out before they could spread to more populous areas. So for people, the future is looking a little bit stark, unless you're actually a new disease, in which case you've got a lot of bright career options ahead of you. You get to travel. You can meet exciting new people that you get to kill. Because effectively, we're providing new diseases and viruses with the ideal laboratory conditions to actually mutate and perfect their art. Mm. There are a lot of factors at play. Partly it's increased global mobility, a warming climate, the spread of urbanization, and of course, our integrated and industrial food production chains that tend to cluster animals together in very high concentrations. So it's almost like a Moore's law for illness. We're helping to speed up the process of the evolution of viruses.
In what ways?
Well, traditionally, viruses take a while to emerge. They take a while to establish and spread themselves. So if a virus pops up in an isolated bat colony, for example, it might ravage through that community and then burn itself out. We're creating environments where newer viruses that emerge, they can spread through large animal populations. They mutate as they go, which makes them deadlier. They get to refine themselves. They become more infectious, and they can quickly jump across to other species. I could say that, you know, I'm not trying to scare people, but, you know, why lie? I like a bit of scary. According to an article titled Plague by Deborah McKenzie in New Scientist, a project by the U.S. Agency for International Development called PREDICT is searching for new disease hotspots, and they found 984 viruses. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but 815 of those were new to science. Yeah. So if you think about all the damage that recent pandemics have done, from flu to SARS to MERS, they've been amongst the 169 viruses that we know about. So what are these 815 unknown ones going to do if we let them into the world?
When do we get to the life-affirming part?
Well, no, the fact that I'm, you know, the fact that we're sitting here and we're talking about this is actually part of the good news. If it sounds like, you know, we're at the edge of an abyss, it's actually an abyss we're walking away from. So we might not be able to prevent these viruses from appearing, but we are improving rather our ability to anticipate and to respond to these viral threats. So when you look at the most recent pandemic threats like MERS and SARS, the versions we've seen have actually been relative pussycats in the infectious disease department, but Ebola was actually a real kind of wake-up call. It demonstrated that there were no coordinated global forces that could be put into play apart from quarantining entire countries. So it's forced a change in organizations like the World Health Organizations, which have traditionally been about policy making rather than actually concentrating on action. So it's forced them into a more kind of active participating role.
So what are the changes we're seeing?
Some of them are economic. One of the reasons that we managed to eradicate a lot of diseases in the 20th century is because the search for cures and vaccines tended to be underwritten by governments in terms of both research and production costs. So we've seen a lot of privatization in the world's pharmaceutical complex since the end of the Second World War. And of course, that's set the industry on a different, more profit-motivated path. And often that means they look at things like complicated cancer drugs for rich Western countries or drugs that someone will have to take for the rest of their life to alleviate a chronic condition. Life-saving one-time immunizations aren't really very profitable. Spending a huge amount of money to research and develop a drug that stops a disease from gaining a foothold is much more of a social good than an economic one. So, you know, drug companies want more customers rather than fewer customers. So preventing the occurrence of pandemics isn't actually a big part of their business model.
So how is the WHO breaking that model?
Well, now they're actively looking into funding approaches that will compensate companies and make it more attractive for them to develop everything from new antibiotics to new antivirals. And they're also looking at ways to streamline the approvals procedure. So typically drugs go through quite a lot of stages approved by national bodies before they can be approved for human trials. And that process can be very long and it's very, very expensive. Mm. So some of those regulations we saw being waived in the case of Ebola, where experimental drugs were pushed through a lot of the phases in months instead of years. So experimental drugs were effectively being used on sufferers of the disease. But these changes are also opening the door to a lot of smaller biotech startups. These guys can be more nimble. They can specialize in very specific areas. And it frees them from the financial the potential financial ruination of clinical and human trials and the huge costs of production. So it allows them to concentrate on innovation and discovery, and they know that somebody else further down the chain will pick up those big ticket costs to actually get the medicines out to people.
So how else is technology being brought to bear?
Some of it's very straightforward in terms of logistics. You can think of it almost like the Amazon.com model, it sounds trite, but it's actually
three
clicks away. Yeah. Thank you. Very nicely put. Developing countries are often the hardest hit in any plague outbreak because they don't have the infrastructure that developed nations have to get critical care to where it's needed. So development agencies have become better at delivering food and other supplies getting those to where they're needed in disconnected parts of the world. So the WHO is finally partnering with these agencies to use their distribution infrastructure to get medicines and immunizations out to people. And of course, this is going hand in hand with the use of big data. We've seen how Google has used its search data to track influenza outbreaks. The WHO is actually trying to pitch a little bit higher. So viral hotspots are plotted and monitored to see if viruses are making the jump from their animal hosts to us with greater ease or greater frequency. Levels of immunization and general population immunity are also plotted. Political and environmental considerations, such as wars or droughts, which of course can influence whether pandemics are more or less likely to take hold, all of these things have to be combined, and it's a very kind of complicated data operation. And of course, there's surveillance, not in the sense that we were talking about last week with cameras and drones, but in terms of actually sharing information. You know, we've seen in the past hospitals and clinics can be very slow to share patient information, even in the same town, let alone with the kind of X-Men and the Avengers of global public health. So getting accurate and timely information, especially from, you know, parts of the world that have an information donkey track rather than a superhighway, it requires the ability of teams to put together information from a huge number of sources and a huge number of formats. And of course, not all of those are going to be digital.
Well, will this be enough to save us?
I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Frieda, you and I are going to die. Jeff has long since relocated to the cloud, so as long as the lights are on, Jeff will be here. But the chances of the rest of us making it into our 80s or even 90s is looking much better than it ever has, you know. And I think all of us are going to be around to bore subsequent generations with our tales of climate change and sickness and an obsolete communications network we call the internet.
You see, we always like to end Friday on a high note. Thanks, Matt. He'll still Matt Amtish from culturepop.com. He'll still be here with Jeff Sandu for Geek Squawk right after this. Stay tuned to Tech Talk BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.